Aristotle understood that. But you cannot imagine time without motion. Time is motion, regardless. Regardless. So time will pass by. Will pass by. It is. Time is always on the move. You'll be left out. If a boy, for instance, the precious possession for a young man is time. When I say young man, I don't mean a boy in his a teenager, I mean even younger. I would say up to 40 is the precious, most precious possession of time. Because still the mind is absorptive, the mind is fertile and absorptive, the retention, the power of retention is still perfect, still good at 40, still good. At least it was good when I was 40. Still 40, I can acquire a lot of knowledge, I can enrich my personality. I can actually accumulate knowledge in the same way as people try to accumulate money, gold. But what do you have from gold, even if accumulated? Nothing. But if you accumulate knowledge, it means you exalt your own personality, you enhance your mind. You become sensitive. You gain wisdom, intuitive wisdom, and so forth. If you utilize time, that means that time that he possesses time. If one is negligent and lets time pass, so it means he's possessed by time. Time owns him. He's shaped and influenced by time, and simply it's a waste. It's exactly. It refers not only to individuals, to nations as well. The nations, I'll take for instance a nation like China, the nation's nation, thousands of years. And actually, if you compare what China has accomplished in the last 10, 15 years, I mean, mechanically, scientifically, as far as prestige in the world is concerned, I mean, don't forget that in 1937, I believe, I don't remember the year exactly, Japan attacked China. They invaded a large part of China, and China was completely powerless, couldn't defend itself. But then the League of Nations fell apart because of that, you see. So it means that thousands of years were wasted. And take a country like America, how old is the United States? 200 years. What the United States has accomplished in 200 years is amazing. To me, it is a phenomenon which is almost borders on the miraculous. If you compare it with historical development, is usually slow and piecemeal. And the giant steps America made in all fields, scientific field, technological field, and so forth, economic field, are amazing. America took hold of time. Time is something qualitative, not only quantitative. It is the clock on the wall. It's not. It is time. Is a qualitative. It's a great experience. And some people can get hold of time and harness time and direct time toward a great goal. And some people are dragged along this time. Youth passes, middle age passes. Before you realize, you're all. They are all foolish and poor. Really, I mean. And by nature, I was not lazy. I'm not a lazy person. I'm a diligent person. I don't try to brag about it. But now, looking backward, I feel sometimes that I've wasted too much time. As I know what knowledge means to a person, and no person can appreciate knowledge as the old person. If knowledge is important to the ones, for the person, the middle-aged person, it's certainly important when a man reaches old age. Very important, because the world of the old man, if he's ignorant, is a very bleak and dreary world. Very bleak. That's what Chazal say, Zikne amoretz kozman samaskinim, if a person is ignorant, the older he gets, the more ignorant he is. But Zikne Talmidei Chachamim, scholars, intelligent persons have stored up knowledge, we have a reserve of wisdom and knowledge, calls man shemaskinin daitam nisefet alayim. Their intelligence becomes more exalted. And it is true. The question now of the senior citizen, what is the question? You know what the question is? The senior citizen, who has no pride, I'm not speaking about the economic problem of the senior citizen, I mean the psychological problem. Who has nothing to do, I mean, he has financial security, I mean, but he has no knowledge and doesn't know how to spend time. No, if you can't spend time properly, so he begins to think about his age and about death and gets frightened. So that's exactly what, this is the tragedy of the senior citizen. As a matter of fact, I've never seen I've known in my life many old men, but I don't remember that an old man should be dejected, depression because of old age is something new which is due to our modern life and our outlook on life. Zikne, on the contrary, Zikne used to inspire a person and plant pride, give him a sense of pride and understanding. Of course, society handled him differently than the modern society, contemporary society. But it's a question of time. Let's return to Matisseo. The name Matisseo Bonner means the time which belongs to Matisseo Bonner. They have utilized, I don't know how, just a couple of years, to the utmost, to the fullest extent. And that's all what we say about Matisseo Bonner. We don't thank them, we just say that was a period which is named after Matisseo Bonner. It was their period, their challenge. Each period has a challenge for man. Each age confronts man with a challenge, with a summons, with a demand. Some people understand and some people comply and they respond to the challenge. Matisseo Bonner has responded to the challenge of their time. This is why he is named Matisseo Bonner. All right, let's continue. Next. Matisseo. What kind of a name is it? Matisseo, what kind of a name is it? It's a typical Jewish name. It is plain, in plain English, it is Theodore. Correct? In plain English, it is Theodore. What does Matisseo mean? Given by God, a gift from God. A present from God. Matisseo, a present from God. Matas ko. Matas, the present, ko, from the Almighty. A gift from God. The name is very significant. Why is it so significant? His name could have been Shimon or Reuven or Yehuda or Levi. But it happened. If you want to say it's just a coincidence. And I don't believe in coincidences in Jewish history. Because in Jewish history, we are full of coincidences, so you would not exist, and wiped off the face of the earth. There is no coincidence in Jewish history. Why was he called Matisseo? Here something comes again. It is something which is very typical of the Jewish philosophy of history. Matisseo. Matasko. We have most biblical names. Yeshayo. Yeshayo means God should help. So forth. Yehochos and so forth. But Matisseo means the gift, the present of God. There's another name which is similar to Matisseo, namely Yeinoson. Yeinoson, given by God. But Matisseo is more, I would say, expresses more. The idea reflects a certain idea, which is very important. Very important. Certain idea. Matasio, the gift of God, the present of God. You know, there's an old problem in philosophy of history. You know, the old problem goes back there. You know, it's a problem because Carlyle took such a radical stand on it. But it was even in antiquity already the problem was known to Greek philosophers. In history, actually, who determines history? The crowd or the individual? Who makes history? Who makes history? Yes, sir. Who makes history? You know Carlyle's opinion that individuals make history. Napoleon made history. Napoleon hadn't been born. Who knows? History would have had a different... there would be a different historical destiny, European destiny, and so forth. But you know, Marxism insists that history is made by the crowd, by the mass. Doesn't matter, I mean, by the class, by the labor, the classless society, by labor. Oh, it doesn't matter. What are Jewish viewpoints about it? Sometimes I'm inclined to accept Carlyle's theory that the individual makes history. If in 1956, Eisenhower had been president in 1956, with his state secretary, the idiot Dulles, we would have had all problems pertaining to state of Israel resolved. That time when they joined Russia in condemning them with the occupation of the Sinai Peninsula and the insistence with which they demanded France and England and the Jews Israel should retreat, withdraw, you know, and neither complied with the demand. Eisenhower went on radio and so forth. That's responsible for all the troubles. Of course, the individual has a great influence, no doubt about it. But who makes it? What is Jewish viewpoint about it? Of course, God makes history, but what is the instrument? Of course, this is true. God makes history and he is Ish Mohammed. What I mean, he employs man as instrument. As the tools with which he realizes his will, his scheme. So who plays an important role? Who plays the important role? The individual or the community, let me say? Or the crowd? The community or the crowd? Who plays the important role? It's very hard, I mean, to simply to accept one theory and reject the other one. I mean, there is some truth to both of them. I don't know, I'll just quote a Midrash for you, and I believe the Midrash will tell you what it, I mean, will review, I mean, resolve the problem. Bar gam zeis b'yesom deretz zeyem, le'ma'astim v'le'ga'altim, v'chaleisom lofe bris yitom, And even though when they'll be in the land of their enemies, I have not rejected them, nor have I forsaken them, because I remember the covenant of Amitah. Not on the Midrash, the Gemara already says. V'am gam zeis b'yesam b'eret t'veyem v'ma'astim, I haven't rejected them because I gave them Mordechai and Esther of Shushan Avir. So the time of crisis. Time of crisis. Lechaleisom v'legealtim shemadeti lehem matisyo bonav. I gave them matisyo and his children. B'nei chashmenai. In the time of the Maccabim, in order to hold them. V'legi'alti v'afadris itom. The Gemara says, so the Midrash says, shemadeti lehem Rebbe v'chavera. Rebbe was very friendly with the governor of Israel, the Roman governor, and he protected the community from many cruel edicts and ruthless policies. It's very strange. The Midrash tries to explain that HaKadosh Baruch Hu, even though he exiled the people from Eretz Israel and they were dispersed all over the world, but in times of crisis, in times of disaster was near, was about to strike, he protected them. So the Midrash could have said, V'ad gam zeis b'yesom v'eretz zeyem le'ma'astim, I haven't rejected them, I haven't rejected them, Sheishaite Isom, I have helped them, B'nai Mordechai Vester and Shushan Abira, I helped them simply. Haman failed in carrying out his plan. And then Rafa Brisitom, like Galtin, Rafa Brisitom should have said, She Shaitei Som B'nai Chashmenoim, I helped them. And that does not say that God helped them, and that's why it's a proof that God has never forgotten, forsaken the people. But the man says, I gave them in certain individuals. I gave them Mordechai Vester, I gave them Matisya Ubonov, I gave them Ezra Vechaverov, Rebbe Vechaverov. You see, what you derive from that Medrash is that it is the individual plays a very important role. It's not in conflict with what I said before. That later when an individual discharges his duty, he retreats into anonymity. But as long as the individual is necessary and his presence is indispensable, so the individual plays a great role. Great role in that. And sometimes, for instance, if Mordechai had not been in Shushan HaBira, and Esther, I mean, hadn't been the queen, I mean, certain events which actually led up to her selection as queen, if certain events hadn't taken place, the Jews would have been in terrible dilemma, you understand very well. So the role of the individual and the fact that Matisyahu lived in that in a certain era, in a certain epoch, was the gift of God. The individual inspires the crowd. The individual is the prophet who arouses the crowd, the community. The final accomplishment belongs to the community. But however, the individual is the teacher, you see. When Carlyle spoke about hero, there are no heroes in Jewish history. There's only one hero in Jewish history. Name the Almighty. Hashem Gidol Muhammad. There are no heroes in Jewish history. Human heroes don't exist. You've never worshipped heroes. They've never deified heroes. Take for instance the German history, they deified heroes. And the same is true in Greek mythology. I mean, they deified heroes. The Jews have never deified any hero. They always knew that the greatest of heroes is the human being. As my man, as Chazal says, Hayim Khan today is here on the Mohammed Quran, tomorrow is in the grave. I mean, there's no hero worship. But as I said before, there is gratitude, there is appreciation. Not idolization, but appreciation. Gratitude. The individual is the teacher, not the prophet, the teacher, not the hero. He inspires, he arouses, he leads. And then, I mean, the community takes over. When the Jews, for instance, have made the golden calf, so HaKadosh Baruch Hu told Moshe Lech Reid, descend. So the Medrash says, Kulum Nasatil of Gdula, I bestowed glory upon thee, and of the Shvil Yisrael, not for your sake, but for the sake of the community. If the community has committed a sin and lost its glory, so you cannot retain your glory. You have to descend. It's a strange combination. The individual is important, not as a hero, as a teacher. What is Matisyahu a teacher? Interesting is Chazal speak of Matisyahu Bonov as Bezdin Chashmenoev, the Bezdin of the Chashmenoev. As if Matisyahu Bonov were, what shall I say, Rabbonim. That being Rabbonim, they comprise the Bezdin. As a matter of fact, there are many halachas which the Gemara attribute to Bezdin Shof Chashmenoev. Many halachas, many laws, takonis, interpretations, which the Gemara attribute to Bezdin Shof Chashmenoev. He is the teacher, not the hero. As a teacher, the individual is very important. So the relation, even David HaMelech. You know, when you study the Gemara Brachot about David, you get the impression that Chazal had a tendency to portray David not as a king, as a warrior, but as a Rosh Hashanah. Rosh Hashanah. So David, and it's not the fault of Chazal. In Tman Yapeh, when you read Tman Yapeh, this psalm, and David describes himself, portrayed himself as a teacher, as a student, as a teacher is more interested in law, in halacha, than strategy and military strategy or warfare. Why did Chazal do it? Why did Chazal try to project an image of David, which prima facie is incomprehensible? David is the great warrior, the hero on the field of battle. David and Job and Yeov, two pals, two friends, commander-in-chief, the united Eretz Yisrael, the Jewish people, and we extended the borders of Eretz Yisrael, both south and north, and the west, and in the east. Why is it? Because the greatest person you have is the teacher, not the king. Not the king. We are not interested in kings. And if we respect the king, and if we appreciate him, and if we remember him with love and tenderness, it's because the king becomes the teacher. Because already in Chumash, boy b'shifti al kisei mamlachti, as soon as he'll sit on his, he'll sit down on his throne, the kosav leis vishni atev azeis, right away he has to order on him, that somebody should write for him the sefer, the korob beikol yemechayim, and he should study the Torah all his life, without interruption. He's already the king of the scholar. It's not the Platonic philosopher, very far. It's not there. There's nothing in common. There's nothing there. But the king is the great teacher. David Sheves Tach Kemeni, the Gemara says, David spent his time in debates, in halachic debates, the teacher. The Chashmonaim are also teachers. That's Matas Kot. Because you don't believe in just arousing people emotionally. We don't believe in that. We don't believe in this revivalist method. It's a Christian, it's an old Christian approach, revivalism. It goes back to the early period of Christianity. They never taught anybody. Christians, they never taught anybody. They tried to indoctrinate and brainwash, to inspire by performing miracles and whatnot. The relationship was a purely emotional one. You study the gospel, you see. While in Yahadus, we never tried to inspire. We always tried to teach. There's a lot to be taught in Yahadus. Matas Kot, because Matisyon was a great teacher. And as a teacher, the individual plays a great role. But there is one difference between the teacher and the hero. The teacher must have his students. There is no teacher without students. And the worth of the teacher is always dependent, the value of the teacher, upon his students. They determine the value, they appreciate it. And that is what Matisyahu was. Matisyahu. Chazal call him Beznishol Chashmonai. Never Chashmonai, Beznishol Chashmonai. The Bezdin, the court, was the Sanhedrin of the Chashmonai. Matisyahu apparently was the Reish Bezdin, the chief justice of the court. Now let's continue. Yeah. Malchus Yovan Osho. Malchus Yovan Osho, the wicked kingdom of Yovan. Yovan is Greece, of course. Actually, it wasn't Greece, I told you. It was in the post-Alexandrian period when his empire fell apart, disintegrated. And the Syrian kingdom, this branch, invaded the Near East. So why do you call it Malchus Yovan Osho? The authors of the Alanisim knew very well who the enemy was. Didn't make any mistake. They were not ignorant of the fact that I mean, that the enemy did not consist of Greeks, of genuine Greeks. Another people, another kind of race, who knows what kind of race it was at that time, which were just assimilated into the Greek culture. They assimilated to the Greek language, most probably, the higher strata of society. I don't believe that everybody spoke Greek at that time. But the higher the intelligentsia, the ruling class probably spoke Greek. They used to be dressed like Greeks. Their habits and mores were Greek, Hellenistic. That's all. Why does the Mechaber, whoever he was, the author, quite possible that he was a contemporary of the Cheshbonai, who knows? Colossus identified them as Greeks, Malchus Yovan also. Why blame Yovan for something which Yovan has never committed? Done. For a crime which Yovan agrees has never committed. Somebody else committed it. Yes. Why is it called Malchus Yovan also? It's not a mistake, it's not an error. I mean, I've told this properly then, they knew where they are. I mean, they knew very well who they are and what they are. The Maccabees knew very well who their enemy was. There was no problem of misrepresentation or... Why did the identity of the enemy is Malchus Yavan Osho? Why? Basically, what happened at that time? What happened? What was new in history, in Jewish history, in the pre-Maccabean period? I mean, the pre-Maccabean, before the war broke out. What was? Something strange happened. It was the first time the Jewish history was confronted with something new. With something new, with a new phenomenon. With something which simply the contemporaries of Matisseau couldn't understand. It was a new experience, a strange alien experience. What happened? The first time in Jewish annals, then it occurred and reoccurred on them quite frequently. What was new? No. Nine examples of dealing can be happy during Tachos time and whole Tanakh is... No. Religious persecution. We have never met with religious persecution to prevent Jews from observing the law and make them violate the basic principles of Yahadus. Is the first experience in the Jewish annals. Before that, religious persecution was unknown. The first time that we called Chedutas Hadaas, religious persecution. That was the first time. Before, you don't know. All right, I mean. There were times of deviationism in Jewish history, yes. But idolatry and so forth. Deviationism. The persecution of those who wanted to observe, to abide. This was the first experience with which our people met in the pre-Maccabean period. There was no religious persecution in Jewish annals before that. The first time. And basically many laws pertaining to Kiddush Hashem, and to Kuach Nefesh, especially if somebody actually, a tyrant, forces a Jew to violate the law, what is the Jew supposed to do under the threat of death, should he incur death, martyrdom, and observe the law, or should he give in for a while? I mean, all the laws, Yorek Yavar, Yavar Yorek, of course, they were later formulated in the time in the post-Beter, the post-Bar Kokhba debacle, but the laws were formulated, the beginning of the laws is to be found in the pre-Maccabean period. Already the Jew already was confronted with a new problem, a new shaila. How should he act? If some tyrant tells him, either you worship the idol, or you'll be killed. And he said, Kiddush Hashem, the problem of Kiddush Hashem emerged in the pre-Maccabean period. and therefore the service that defiled the Beis HaMikdash was not because of carelessness. No. It was a malicious act. It was a part of the scheme of the Rebbe Sadara, of the religious persecution. Yes. Now, what was it due to? Why? Responsible for it is Greek, is the Greek culture. The disdain, because when Alexander Magnus, actually, when Alexander Magnus began to extend his empire, and he wanted to conquer, he had a dream of conquering the world, and he was killed on his march to India. But when his dream was not just a dream of conquering the world, very, very strange. You say, it was not a dream just of conquering the world for the sake of conquest, for the sake of power. He was a missionary. A missionary from whom? The Greek culture. To bring the Greek message or the Greek gospel to every primitive barbarian tribe or nation. And the whole world consisted of barbarians. So the whole world was, you know, divided into two sects, into two groups, the Hellenes and the barbarians. And his job was to civilize the world, as the British Empire later, right directly. The British Empire, also Germany, not during Hitler's time, but in 1914, the First World War, when Germany declared war on England and France and Russia, it also was imbued with the spirit, the missionary spirit, to bring the German culture, the Deutsche culture, to all barbarian people. Yeah. Who is barbarian, ever is not a German, and does not wear a uniform, as the Reichswehr. This was Alexander Magnus. And that exactly, when the people get, develops a fixation of mission, there is one exemption to that rule, exception to that rule. The Jew, and I'll explain you why, explain to you why. When the people develop, the idea of mission, that I have to conquer the world in order to civilize it, or in order to raise mankind in a state of barbarity and primitiveness to that of civilization and culture, religious persecution is inevitable. Because the barbarians don't want to be taught. And the barbarians think that their code, moral code, is just as good as that of Plato and Aristotle. And so don't forget, Aristotle was the teacher of Alexander Magnus. And that their morality is as high as that of the cultured and sophisticated Greeks. So in the beginning, they refuse to accept the moral code, the gospel which is offered by the Greeks. So once they refuse to accept the moral code, the gospel which is offered by the Greeks, so what is the result? Persecution. You try to enforce it. You try to impose it. And that leads to persecution. That was true with regard to Christianity too. Christianity is also a missionary religion. We are not a missionary religion. We don't want to bring our Bible to the entire world. We'll never try. On the contrary, we are reluctant to accept giving. I mean, you know what's going on in Israel now. Somebody come, somebody come to the priest, he wants to convert to Christianity. He would do it immediately. But on the contrary, they are trying to get his snatched souls as many as possible. But here comes the Gears, so Rabbi Nathroy will say, come back in a year, in 2 years. All right, that's what it is. The human cries in Nathroy, the Rabbi Nathroy, as far as conversion is concerned. We are reluctant to accept Gears. We are reluctant. For many reasons, as a variety of things. Anyway. Yeah. So you've never been a missionary. We got the Torah for ourselves. We don't want to sell it to anybody else. No export business. We don't want to raise the mankind from primitiveness to an exalted position of humanity. We are not missionaries. Had we been missionaries, we could have captured the world, you know. Had we been missionaries. So Rome, when Rome was about to shake off idolatry, during that twilight period at Rome, And there are hundreds and hundreds of aristocratic families which converted to Judaism. Even the imperial family had members who secretly, clandestinely, professed Judaism. If we were a missionary people, we would have proselytized Rome, not the Christians. And if we had proselytized Rome, you know what would have happened? So Europe would have been Jewish. I always think about what image, what the kind of Judaism which would have evolved if actually we had converted Rome to Judaism. Perhaps the whole world would be a different world. Perhaps the destiny of mankind would be different. I don't know. But we are not a missionary people. Thus, there is no religious persecution now. I know the Saudi police will be the persecutors and force other people. On the contrary, the Rambam says, you cannot tell a non-Jew to observe Jewish law, because the Jewish law was given to a Jew. He has no right to impose it. Or you can demand some other people to observe the same mitzvah. Same mitzvahs are simply the foundation of civilized life. Against idolatry, murder, incest, the requirement for a civil code, for civilized life, there should be justice, and that's all. Because we are not a missionary people. And then we could have captured the East, the Orient. It was before Mohammed came. Also, the Arab tribes, the many Arab tribes, which were primitive idolaters, pagans, began to doubt the worth and the value of their polytheistic religion. And there were many converts to Judaism already in Arabia. As a matter of fact, in Medina there were many. And Mohammed's anti-Semitism was due to the fact that the Jews opposed him. If the Jews had been more dynamic, more mission conscious, and more aggressive and bolder, they would have converted all Arabs to Judaism. Again, I'm asking, what kind of a Jew he would have now? But this is true. You see, the Maimon Chazal, that HaKadosh Baruch Hu came and offered the Torah to Esau, which means Rome. Esau is always Rome. And he offered the Torah to the Yishmael of Bnei Leit, and that is the Arab population. It's not just a story. It's based on, it's not just a story, it is history. There was a time when there was a distinct possibility to convert Esau, meaning Rome, to Judaism. And by converting Esau to Judaism, we would have conquered the European continent. Because Rome was the center of civilization and culture. But somehow we have not succeeded. And the reason is because we are not missionaries. There's a lack of aggressiveness on our part. We are not bold. We are more inner-directed, introspective as a group, and we are not interested anymore. So we are now 40 million people. That's all. It could have been 500 million. And that's exactly Alexander Magnus. He was the first missionary, actually. He combined military tactics these three cultures. He conquered the land not only to control the land politically, but to implant Greek culture, Greek ideas, Greek code of ethics, and so forth. Of course, he failed. He failed miserably, but those who succeeded him still retained the idea of spreading and disseminating Greek culture, philosophy. And of course, Judea refused. Judea resisted, did not succumb. So religious persecution was initiated. Our refusal to comply with the missionary complex of the Syriacs Hellenized Syriacs actually was the reason for introducing religious persecution. So basically the people are not Greek, but we are responsible for it. The Greek mentality, the Greek culture, Greek vanity, Greek pride, the idea that the whole world consists of barbarians. Only the Hellenes are culture. The matter of fact is very important. I told it last year to somebody from here. From the hierarchy in Rome, from the Catholic hierarchy in Rome. He asked me a question. He said, why is the... He said that they are not not only they are not responsible for the Hitler Holocaust, but more than that, they helped Jews during the Hitler period. This, in terms of statistics, it's very hard to contradict him, nor is... You see, some did help, some did help, some didn't. The Poles, the priesthood in Poland were cooperated, with certain exceptions, with the Nazi, with the Gestapo cooperated. As a matter of fact, I read the memoirs of a Jew who was disguised as a Catholic and a Goy during the Hitler occupation of Poland, and he once came to confess, for confession, and he confessed to the police that he doesn't know. He said it was not whether it was a sin or it's a goody that he saved the Jew, he protected the Jew, and prevented him from falling into the hands of the Gestapo. And the priest told him it's a venial sin, and he said, repent, and next time when you see the Jew, you should deliver him to the Gestapo. I mean, the Jew later wrote memoirs. And, there were certain priests who helped Jews. Not too many, there were. In Italy, the situation was much better. The Italian priests were helpful. Not all of them, but. And so forth. To say that the Catholic Church actually stood up, actually, and protected the Jews courageously would be a gross exaggeration. But I told him something else. I said I can't argue with him about the statistics, numbers, I don't know. It's very hard to guess. I know of certain incidents, I mean, both positive and negative incidents. I mean, I cannot argue. But I told him something else. Of course Hitler was not a Christian. He kept on telling me Hitler was not a Christian. Of course he was not a Christian. He was a pagan. He was worthless in that, Hitler. Yeah. Of course. I mean, how is the reason? Hitler's group, I mean, his friends, none of them was a pious Christian, observant Christian. No doubt about it. Hitler himself was a Catholic. So was Goebbels, and so was... The fellow that was Goering, I don't remember about Goering. Anyway, but I told him about something else. If we think about the Hitler Holocaust, with millions of Christians, decent people, civilized people, cultured people, Germany, France, Holland, and so forth, the Baltic countries, have witnessed the slaughter of 6 million Jews, among them little babies, infants. They used to swing them against the brick wall and smash their skulls. Yeah. How is it possible? After all, people sometimes cannot see a wounded dog without getting excited and trying to help the dog. Could see after the murder, systematic murder, extermination. I mean, extermination of old men, middle-aged children. And isn't. It is due to something else. It is due to the preaching of the Church throughout the centuries and millennia, throughout the past 1900 years, that the Jew was cursed by God because he rejected Christ. The Jew is a wandering Jew, has no home. And the Jew is responsible for the fact that Christ has not come back on the second time. Supposed to, but I tell you. He hasn't. I mean. And the Jew, finally, the idea that the Jew is subhuman is a Catholic idea. Of course, you may point out a few theologians in the Catholic Church who are more conscientious and more careful, but usually this is the concept of the Jew, which was supposed, if not cultivated, by the Church and implanted in the Christian by the Church. Now, of course, now perhaps. Perhaps you realize that it was a mistake, an error, a terrible error. Hitler was not a Catholic. But if not for your doctrine, of the eternal Jew and the wandering Jew, and it's not for your constant, continual preaching about the Jew, that he is, so to say, he blocks actually the arrival of your Messiah, the Hitler Holocaust couldn't have taken place. You are not perhaps directly responsible, but indirectly you are responsible. You are the culprit, you are the guilty. It's not a story about Christ killer and deicide and the wandering Jew who renounced the stories about Judas, and with Judas you identify every Jew. I mean, such cruelty couldn't have taken place. Directly perhaps you're right. You are not responsible. Hitler, I wouldn't call it a Christian. But indirectly, it is your fault. And I say it in regard to Malchus Yovan HaRishon. Indirectly, Greece was not responsible for the religious problem. Directly. Like we were a bunch of wild spirits. Who knows what kind of a race they were. I mean, we don't know that, who they were. But certainly it didn't belong to the Hellenes. Hitler, I wouldn't call it a Christian. But indirectly, it is your fault. And I say it in regard to Malchus Yovan HaRishon. Indirectly, Greece was not responsible for the religious problem. Directly. Like we were a bunch of wild Syriacs. Who knows what kind of a race they were. I mean, we don't know that, who they were. But certainly it didn't belong to the Hellenes, not our time. But indirectly, it is Alexander of Mishne. The pride of the Greeks, I mean, your contempt for everybody else, but please.
Kesheomdo Malchus Yovan Osho Alamcho Yisrael. What does it mean, Kesheomdo?
What does it mean, Kesheomdo? So let's move on. What does it mean, Kesheomdo? Kesheomdo Malchus Yovan Osho Alamcho Yisrael. What does it mean, Kesheomdo? What do you say? What? No, but plainly literal, what does it mean, Kesheomdo Malchus Yovan? Rose up. To what? Why do you have to rise? There's no need to rise. What means Kesha Omdo Malchus Yovan HaRishon? Of course, literally means Kesha Omdo rose against thy people. When the wicked Greek kingdom rose against thy people, yes. But what is Kesha Omdo? What does Kesha Omdo mean? There were many terms to it. Could have been used. Kesheomdo means determination. Not just a decision. A decision sometimes, you carry out, and sometimes you react. You change your mind. But if there is a determination, that has got to be done, and that's the major objective of mine, you say Kesheomdo. For instance, for Hitler, I want you to understand. For Hitler, anti-Semitism was not a secondary policy or some a peripheral approach. No, a peripheral philosophy. This was the major objective in the whole philosophy, the wicked philosophy of Nazism, is the destruction of the Jew was a major objective. As for instance, atheism is Marxism. We don't understand it. Why is it necessary for Marxism and socialism to adopt an atheist philosophy? But I don't know. It's a different problem. I don't know. But atheism in Marxism and communism is not just incidental, a peripheral doctrine. No. It is the very foundation of Marxism and communism. Why it is so, I don't know. I could never understand. Well, you know that in Germany they used to have the religious socialists, but what have never succeeded in attracting the masses. Usually, the communist socialist society is an atheist society. And to them, atheism is actually a religion itself. It's a kind of an idol.
And it means to the Malchus, Yovan or Shor, whoever it was the religious persecution or the destruction of Jewish identity was not just incidental. It wasn't incidental. It was a major object. And I want you to know that anti-Semitism for the Christian, who is an anti-Semite, and I am far from being the one to look for anti-Semites under the table or under the bed, or to identify, for instance, hooliganism on New York Street with anti-Semitism. To exaggerate is dangerous. Exaggerate is dangerous. Be careful. Not every act of a criminal or a hooligan, be red, be white, is to be classified as anti-Semitism. Anti-Semitism is not hooliganism, I don't know. It's not far from being hooliganism. I know what anti-Semitism is. Anti-Semitism can be very civilized. They're civilized and sophisticated, and they're refined. I mean, you don't know, Baruch Hashem, you don't know what anti-Semitism is. So you identify it with the wrong phenomenon, not hooliganism. That's why this type of exaggeration is unhealthy, I mean, and it endangers our status in the United States. I mean, this recent fear. I don't know who aroused that fear in us, but this recent fear that our future here is not secure. Very unhealthy for American Jews. You don't have to convince the Goy that he's an anti-Semite. And what the American Jew is doing now is trying to convince the Goy that he doesn't hate him. They don't hate him. They don't love him. It's a dangerous matter. I know in my private life, I've never tried to convince somebody that he's my enemy. If he told me he's my friend, I accept it. Whether I believe him or not, he's even said. But I accept it. But to try hard, you can probably see that. And the commentary does it now. The commentary, the August commentary on her. Yes. That the Jews are insecure in the United States. You see, it's commentary in the paper which represents assimilation. You know. But suddenly it spreaded panic among the Jews in the United States. Trying to convince the Jews, the Goy, actually, that he's not sincere when he says that he is a friend of the Jews. Anyway. So, do you understand me? Anti-Semitism in general, for an anti-Semitic movement, is anti-Semitism never incidental, never peripheral, marginal. Very strange, we don't know why. For he was in Germany, the Deutsche National Party. The Deutsche National Party was a conservative. They represented the capitalists in Germany, industrialists. There was no need for the Deutsche Nation to be anti-Semite. But they were anti-Semite. And anti-Semitism was the central, what shall I say, the central idea in their sort of political world outlook, political philosophy. And that's exactly. Kishomdo Malchus Yovan means determination. It means centrality. Not just incidental. Malchus Yovan had many problems. But one of the problems was, I mean, the subjugation of the spirit of the proud Judeans who did not want to surrender to the Greek culture. No, it was not. Kishomdo means all the deeds, all the thoughts, everything was directed just toward one ultimate goal, namely to subjugate the Jews. This is the word Kishomdo. Determined, relentless, inconsiderate. Very strange. This is one of the strange phenomena in history why anti-Semitism plays such an important role. There was no need for Hitler to be an anti-Semite. He could have gotten everything without being an anti-Semite. It's quite possible if he hadn't been an anti-Semite, he would have gotten everything and a little more than that. So he might have won the war. Driving out the Jewish scientists of Germany, he could have gotten the atomic bomb before America. Quite possible. Anti-Semitism actually is responsible for Hitler's downfall. Of course, he fell before the atomic bomb was invented, was manufactured, produced, but he could have gotten it. He could have. It's quite possible. But this is Kishomdo Malchus Yovan or so. Alamcho Yisroel. What does it mean, Alamcho Yisroel? Two plain words. don't require any interpretation. Alamcho Yisrael.
Where we have the same expression. Where does the same expression recur? The council of Yahweh, I see, where does the same expression, Amcho Yisrael, recur? Yeah. Chotu Ovu Poshu, Lefanecho, Amcho Yisrael. Kapano, Lechatoim, Velavenis, Velapshoim, Sheposhu, Veshechotu, Sheovu, Lefanecho. Shechotu, Sheovu, Sheposhu, Lefanecho, Amcho Yisrael. What does Amcho Yisrael mean? Of course, thy people Israel, of course, it's so simple.
Yes. What does Amcho mean? The Mika Amcho Yisroel, the Echot Vorat, also here. There is emphasis. Kishom Dom Machos Yoga Marsho, Alam Yisroel.
You don't say Alam Yisroel.
You say Alamcho Yisroel. We could have said, Kishom Dom Machos Yoga Marsho, Al Yisroel. It's happened. Or, Kishom Dom Machos Yoga Marsho, Alamcho. Or Alam Yisroel. No. None of those terms was chosen. Proper expression apparently is Alamcho Yisroel. What is Amcho Yisroel express? Yes. This is correct. This is the Ramban says so in Azim. That the hatred of the Jew is not because the enemy does not like the Jew. Due to some physiological traits or physiognomy, then by the nose or the color of the eyes or the hair of the Jew, is the Jew is committed. The Ramban says it's Nazir, because the Jew is committed to God. So basically, the enemy of the Jew is the enemy of God. And it's not only the Ramban. Chazal says, "Kumu adishen v'yefut v'yivecho, v'yenusu v'sanecho v'ponecho." Who are the enemies of God? I mean, what do you mean speaking enemy of God? What can the enemy do to God? So Rashi right there in Bamidbar says, Zeu Eileim Oseinu Yisroel. Kol Oseinu Yisroel, Nikro Oseinu Yisroel HaKadosh Baruch Hu. You're correct. But there is something else to it. Amcho means we belong to thee. Amcho is a possessive noun, you know very well. We belong to thee. We belong to thee, even while we go astray and deviate from the righteous path. We are still committed to thee, but even when we are guilty of certain offenses and of certain sins. In Amcho, what comes to expression in Amcho is the old idea. The old idea. Yisroel af api shechoto, choto Yisroel. Yisroel af api shechoto, Yisroel. The Jew, even when he sins, he remains a Jew. What does it mean? What did Chazal, Rashi quote it. What did Chazal want to express with this expression? Af api shechoto Yisroel. It means there is an eternal commitment in the Jew to HaKadosh Baruch Hu. Sometimes it's a conscious commitment. Sometimes it's an unconscious commitment. But there is a commitment which can never be annulled, can never be severed. That commitment is like a load, like a heavy load, resting upon the frail shoulder of every Jew. We might fight this commitment. We might hate this commitment. But there is a commitment in the part of everything. The Jew is always, basically there is actually extended to men in general, but now we are not interested in that anymore. They make it a universal prayer that men is committed to God. But we are not interested in universal anymore. We are interested now in the particular anymore, as far as the Jew is concerned. The Jew basically cannot cast off. It will completely, I mean, strip him of his inner joy and glory. He will lose his spiritual personality. Chabad call it Havu Ativist. the natural love for God that the Jew possesses. Whether he was trained or he wasn't trained, whether he wants to love God or he doesn't want, there is a natural instinctual drive, urge to find God in the Jew. Many Jews who walk straight to that ultimate goal move in the right direction. Some Jews are searching for God, but they move in their search, they move in the opposite direction. Of course, they are lost sheep. This is the natural, spontaneous drive in man, urging him for God. But it comes to expression, I mean, there's more vigor in the Jew. This is Amcho. We belong to the, there is no way how we can free ourselves from the Al Amcho Yisrael. As a matter of fact, I'll tell you frankly, some people may think it's just a beautiful idea, but it's practically not correct. And many a time I thought so. I began to think to somehow to approach this idea of Avotivis, or Amcho, means compulsory belonging on the part of the Jew to God. Willingly he belongs to it. So I began to doubt that outlook, that philosophy. When I came to America, there was a tremendous assimilationist movement in America. It was assimilation, it's ugly and most vulgar form of it. Particularly the first immigrants who came to America and gave up everything. And then you thought that Russian Jewry is completely lost. And there was no general commitment on the part of the Jew. We were a minority, in a small minority, a limited minority, observing Jews. There was no institution of Chinuch in the United States. Yet a couple of day schools you could never reach. Some towns, they were also disorganized, Batlonis, they were conducted in a Batlonis way, completely. You couldn't be too optimistic about the philosophy of Amcho. That finally, the philosophy of Amcho. I am dying, willy-nilly. I belong to thee, whether I want it or I don't want it. Kayol tarek nafya, kayol tarek alfikun moyen, ki nafshi tarek nafya. I'm like the gazelle, he's thirsty for water. So I'm thirsty for God. It means spontaneously, instinctually. I began to simply to doubt whether it is true or not, even though it's a basic concept in the others. It's not, it doesn't go back to Chazal. Chazal developed it beautifully. Beautifully, particularly the Tanya, the Likudei Kehari. Well, but it's an old. It's an old idea. It's very optimistic. Bayima we talk about the Shefa Godel Boevdim the Ratasho Vanidochim the Rat Mitzrayim. It means the day of remembrance or of the day of awakening will arrive sooner or later. And the Shefa Godel might be an external sound, might be an eternal sound, an inner sound rather. Whether there is a Shefa will frighten the man or his conscience will inspire him, arouse him, I don't know. And even the Evdim, the people who are considered lost, Beretz Asher, Beretz Mitzrayim, will come back. But now two things happened lately which actually corroborate the philosophy of Amcho Yisrael. One thing, if it is true, I don't know, I'm still skeptical, if there is really awakening among the Russian Jews. If it is true, I don't know. They tell me people who come from Russia, I spoke with many Russian Jews, they tell me it is true. I still am skeptical. You know why I am skeptical? Because it borders on the miraculous. Don't forget the revolution in Russia took place in 1917. November 1917. Yeah. All right, now we are Baruch Hashem 1972. So it means two generations who were raised in Russian schools, 80s, from A to Z, materialistic in outlook on the world, on man, and particularly resentful. I don't know why, coming resentful of Judaism, very resentful. I don't know why. In my opinion, it is most probably due to the fact that communism is a philosophy of atheism, as I told you. Atheism is not something marginal, incidental. It's basic and central to communism. And the Jew is the man who gives to the world monotheism. And a philosophy, a world, a community founded upon atheism must hate the community which has brought to the world the gospel of faith in God. But whatever it is, you were raised as communists, as members of the Russian society. The new awakening is taking place in Russia. And again I emphasize, I have doubt whether it is true. That it's just a phenomenon which is limited to a small segment of Russian Jewry, or it is a movement. But if it is a movement, is the philosophy of Amcho Yisrael correct 100%? If after, I would say, 53, 54 years of Russian education and training, young men are ready to cast off, to shed the whole philosophy of communism and go to Eretz Yisrael and identify themselves as Jews, so apparently there is something to the Jew which is indicative of Amcho, which belongs to the Yiri Miri. And no one can take us away from it. Very strange. Because acknowledgement of being a Jew, be it secular, be it religious, is ipso facto an acknowledgement of belonging to God. This is number one. Number two, which fortifies my faith in the philosophy of Amcho Yisrael, is the remarkable commitment on the part of the American Jew to the State of Israel. It's also a miracle to me. I told you many times. Because it's not so simple. It's not a question of just sympathy. It's a question of disagreeing with the government of the United States. And we do demand from the government of the United States to adopt a policy in the Near East which is friendly toward Israel, don't we? Of course. Yeah. And the American Jew of the 30s, whom I found when I came here, was not ready for that. He was not ready for that. He would have never taken the risk. There. It is something new to the American Jew. A new sense of pride, a new sense of courage, and particularly a new awareness of his own identity. And when you have that awareness of your own identity, you know something else. As no matter how distinct we are, and no matter how many languages we speak, and no matter how remote we are from each other geographically, there is a common destiny for all Jews throughout the globe. The American Jew did not have it years ago, not even the 40s during the Hitler Holocaust. And the American Jew had the same awareness as he has now, perhaps millions of Jews would have been saved. He would have stormed the White House. When Roosevelt refused to receive the delegation of rabbis in 1943-44, when the extermination of Jews in Europe reached its height, I mean, if the Jews of 1944 acted the way Jewish youth act now with regard to Russia, which is incomparably different, okay, I cannot say, perhaps he could have succeeded in persuading, or at least in forcing Roosevelt to act. And if Roosevelt had acted, he could have saved a million Jews. That time I thought, actually, in the 40s, the American Jew has forgotten the Amcho. Forgotten the Amcho. Now, I'm encouraged, and I begin to believe that there is something, some metamorphosis has taken place in the American Jewish community. It is more serious than you imagine. There is pride, there is courage, in particular, I said, there is awareness, a clear awareness, that I belong to the people. the great people to the eternal people, and our destiny and commitment is one. Our one. This is Nika. Omdo al Amcho. And of course, because Amcho, then is Yisrael, it's beautiful. That's what I... What is Yisrael? What does Yisrael mean? What's the word? What's the semantics of Yisrael? We just read it 2 weeks ago. What is the semantics of Yisrael? Kisoriso, Melekim, Vanoshim, Vatuchal. What does it mean? You have contended, troubled, wrestled? These king, these angels, the powerful enemy, almost omnipotent enemy, the Manoshim, these powerful, influential people, but to hell. And in spite of all pessimistic predictions, you emerge victorious. Why? Because I'm hot. Because there is a certain commitment on our part to God and to the people, that no power in the world can break it. And if you have that commitment, you are very powerful. If you have that commitment, you are very powerful. What was the secret of the victory of the Hashmoneim? I mean, all right. Helped by HaKadosh Baruch Hu. But the secret was because the Hashmoneim knew we are Amcho. And if we are Amcho, we can never sever our affiliation with HaKadosh Baruch Hu. Never. Even though the affiliation is the source of pain and despair and suffering and misery, and certainly it's not a source of comfort and convenience. But still it belongs to me. So that gives power to person. Absolute commitment is actually, is perhaps the strongest weapon that the individual and the community may will. Because we are Amcho, we are Israel. We contend with many, and we prevail. After all, Buddha says that a pasuk vayovik ishime adalisa shochar is central in Yahadut. I don't know how he explains it. I agree with him, it is central in Yahadut. Because if you'll ask me what is the quintessence of Jewish history, not only in the past 1900 years, but since the establishment, I would say, of the Second Commonwealth. It's a story of 2400 years. What is actually, if you want to characterize Jewish history, the motto of Jewish history, what is it? What is common to all ages and to all eras? What is it? That verse, Vayovik Ishimei Adalei Teshvach. We are always in position, in opposition to something, or rather, somebody or something is in opposition to us. What it is? The issues, there is a number of issues. There was an issue during the Second Commonwealth. It was the issue of Shabbos. The institution of Shabbos was disliked by the Greeks. Not only Greeks, but the Romans and Greeks. Rabbi Sanhedrin. There was a story circulated in the Near East, that the Jews have in the Holy of the Holies, in the sanctuary, in the Kodesh Kodashim, the head of a donkey, which is worshipped every Yom Kippur when the archpriest had entered the Kodesh Kodashim. Of course, it was such a real Saddam. It was, you see, Russian Holy is a potent weapon. The rumor was so not annoying. Actually, it constitutes the menace to the Jew that Josephus Flavius wrote a book, Contra Apionem. Apio was the famous anti-Semite Alexandre, where he also, tries to refute the story about the head of the donkey. The head of the donkey. Then, later in the Middle Ages, later became the problem of the Talmud. The Talmud became the symbol of Jewish uniqueness which the Christian church hated. How many times did they burn the Talmud? Not only the Talmud, but those who studied the Talmud with the Talmud. So you say for the Talmud, you have a kinnis maram rutenberg. הוא יסוד איתן יקיט עשר לסלופה באש, הוא השלם עשר רואיך, דרך השלם יחזים יסר עד רואיך. טוב. Then there was a story matter, blood libel. You don't know how much blood will you spill for that blood libel story. I mean, we have no idea. Later the Jew became the symbol of capitalism, of money, the money lender. It's a Shylock, under the great Shakespeare. Tariq Adar. Shylock. Don't think Shylock had a tremendous impact upon the Goyim. Don't fool yourself, Shylock is out. Because it's out. It's more dangerous. Tremendous impact on the Goyim. So the Jews called Shylock. I mean, I don't know why, but in America they called the Jew Shylock. But I remember as a young boy, Scotty used to run after me and call me Shylock. Shylock? They didn't know what Shylock is, but they knew it's a better word anyway. And then the Jew became the representative of capitalism. Marx, the great Marx, who was a Jew himself. Well, the Jew, the dollar for the Jew, I mean, is his God and so forth. So anyway, now the object of hatred is the state of Israel. The object of hatred is the state of Israel. If an anti-Semite attacks a Jew, is that you cannot attack a Jew. You need a certain objective. The objective is now the state of Israel. It is opposition and intention by and daybreak, I don't know, I don't see it, daybreak. The morning star will finally rise, but I don't know when, finally. But in Ayovik Ishime Kolalaila, the whole night. And, of course, we have lost many, we have lost greatly 6 million Jews, 1/3 of our population, but on the whole, we emerge victorious. We still retain our identity. We still belong, are committed to the same goal to which our ancestors, thousands of years ago, millennia ago, were committed. And we still assemble from time to time and study the Torah. This is Kishomdom Marcus Yovan Osho, Alamcho, which will never sever its affiliation with the Almighty. And who emerged victorious many times from all engagements. So the foolish Marcus Yovan thought, as Brezhnev thinks now, that it's possible to erase that identity. It was a mistake then, it's a mistake now. All right. This is Rabo. We are more than rocky, we say, 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 we are more than rocky, we say